It's the Bert Cohen Show. History gets weirder and weirder and stranger as it goes along. What's going on with ISIS or ISIL? We know what we're talking about. It has a bunch of different names, but I don't know about you, but for me, it has seemed for a long time like there's more to this than meets the eye. I mean, they're the bad guys, the evil guys who just seem to spring up out of nowhere. But of course, they didn't spring up out of nowhere. We're going to find out a lot more about what ISIS is, what the phenomenon is, and what the context is, and what the role of the United States may have been in, frankly, the birth of this terrorist gang, ISIS. I'm very pleased to have with us somebody who knows quite a bit about this subject, Nicholas J.S. Davies. Nicholas, thanks so much for being with us on the Bert Cohen Show.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Bert.
Well, Nicholas Davies is author of Blood on Our Hands, The American Invasion and the Destruction of Iraq. He also wrote the chapter on Obama at War for the book Grading the 44th President, a report card on Barack Obama's first term as a progressive leader. I don't know who thinks of him as a liberal, but whatever. He was elected in opposition to the war in Iraq. Our guest, Nicholas Davies, wrote an article on the various media titled Since 9/11, America's Insane Foreign Policy Continued Under Obama Has Killed a Million and Created ISIS. Davies writes that one of the obvious but unlearned lessons of September 11th, that creating and arming groups of religious fanatics as proxies to fight secular enemies has huge potential for blowback and unintended consequences as they gain power and escape external control. Well, relate that statement that you wrote to what happened on September 11th with regard for, I know a lot of American leaders, members of Congress, supported the Mujahideen fighters in Afghanistan against the Soviet Union. And then look what happened. So say more about that that sentence you wrote there, please.
You would think this would be a very obvious lesson to all of us in this country and around the world and to our leaders. But sadly, tragically, this seems to be a lesson that we are being condemned to repeat and to learn over and over again.
Does seem to be the case.
You know, faced with secular enemies, you know, of course, back in the 80s, it was under the guise of fighting communism and opposing the Soviet Union. But even without a Soviet Union, without, without many other countries in the world are ruled by communism, somehow nothing seems to have changed in U.S. policy. Our leaders were still willing to back fundamentalist jihadis in Libya and then in Syria with the goal of overthrowing secular regimes that our leaders didn't like, and I think as we saw in Afghanistan in the 1980s, and as we are learning again, this is just a tragic mistake, and the inevitable consequences. You know, there's a common saying that the definition of insanity is to keep right. doing the same thing and expecting a different result.
Yes.
And by that definition, you know, our government, our military-industrial complex, the powerful, powerful interests that, that drive a lot of this, are frankly insane.
It does kind of appear that way. And the piece that you wrote also points out that since the awful tragedy of 9/11, the U.S. has launched more than, let's see, I wonder what people would guess, how many airstrikes the United States has launched since 9/11? Well, the answer is nine.
Well, I can answer that question because I seem to be one of the few people that has actually kept track of that, even though the Pentagon does put out regular documents detailing that. We have now conducted 95,000 airstrikes, at least 95,000. There may be some others that are unreported, but the ones reported by the Pentagon, that's 95,000 airstrikes in 13 years. And there's really been no tailing off of that under the Obama administration,
right.
under a Nobel Peace Prize winner. Under Obama, there have been at least 25,000 airstrikes, mostly in Afghanistan and mostly essentially unreported by our media.
And it's interesting. I am old enough to remember the secret war on Cambodia that was launched by Kissinger in 1970 or so. You know, it was not exactly a secret from the people of Cambodia. And it was massive, massive bombing against a people living in very primitive conditions. And the direct result of that, it seems to me, was the killing fields of Pol Pot. That didn't come out of nowhere. There was this tremendous violence launched from the sky. And what kind of reaction is there? And I wonder, you know, we're looking at the creation of ISIS here, which is, you know, they're not nice guys, shall we say. But you and most Americans really, I don't think, have any idea how many dead and how many injured have been the results of those 95,000 airstrikes on Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia. Any clue that you have, Nicholas?
Well, yeah. I mean, the heaviest casualties of all have clearly been in Iraq during, you know, what was called the shock and awe assault on Iraq in 2003. That was comprised of 29,000 airstrikes. I think, you know, it's important to for people to understand. We have, you know, since the first Gulf War in 1991, there's been really an amazingly sophisticated propaganda campaign by the Pentagon and you know, supported by the corporate media in this country to convey the impression that the airstrikes that the U.S. conducts today, you know, with our modern so-called precision weapons, are somehow qualitatively different than, you know, the horrors that we all know of in World War II, the Blitz of London, the firebombing of Dresden, the firebombing of Tokyo, and of course the
right.
Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But you know, in military circles, there has always been a debate between the relative effectiveness of precision bombing versus carpet bombing or area bombing. And, you know, we have been given the impression that all of our bombing now is incredibly precise, that as, in fact, you know, the liberal pundit Christopher Hitchens said in the lead-up to, in fact, on the eve, on the March the 18th, the day before the bombing, the shock and awe, mm-hmm. bombing began in Iraq, and what he said was, it can now be proposed as a practical matter that one is able to fight against a regime and not a people or a nation. This is the sort of central plank of U.S. propaganda in the, for the past, you know, 20-odd years. And in fact, as in 1991, in the first Gulf War, as the Pentagon was flashing bombsight video onto our TVs around the world to show how precise the bombing was, it was later revealed that only 7% of the bombs and missiles raining down on Iraq at that time were actually classified as precision weapons. 93% of the bombing was good, old-fashioned carpet bombing. And a UN report after the war described the destruction of Iraq at that time as, quote, near apocalyptic.
Wow.
So then we come to 2003. You know, the weapons technology had certainly advanced, but still only 65% of the weapons in Shock and Awe were, in fact, precision weapons. And by professional estimates, only about 75 to 80% of those so-called precision weapons actually performed correctly with precision, landing within, mm-hmm. you know, 40 feet of a target. So, in fact, out of those 29,000 bombs and missiles raining down on Iraq, only about half performed like the ones that we were shown on our TV screens, you know, hitting actual targets. You know, the rest were just essentially the same as the bombing that we know of from World War II and Vietnam and previous horrific cases of aerial bombardment of countries and societies and civilians.
So about...
And so then when an epidemiological team working for Baghdad University and Johns Hopkins concluded that the first 3 years of the war in Iraq had killed 650,000 people as an approximate estimate. And that was only the first 3 years of war. More recent estimates have concluded quite rationally that you know, within another few years, that number had risen to probably about 1 million Iraqis killed. You know, that really, there shouldn't have been anything controversial or suspect about those figures. And yet, once again, our you know, what I refer to as our propaganda system, the military propaganda system and the corporate media who parrot whatever they're told, you know, really launched a campaign to cast doubt on those figures. But really, these were very thorough studies, and the result of that kind of bombing is inevitably mass civilian casualties, and this is what we have seen.
I find it, if you just tuned in to the Burt Cohen Show, our guest today is Nicholas J.S. Davies, author of Blood on Our Hands, The American Invasion and Destruction of Iraq. And we're looking at the roots of the current fight with ISIS. And, you know, as I look at massive bombing campaigns in Vietnam, in Cambodia, in England, it's what it does is make people extremely angry, extremely angry. And as it, you know, Kissinger's bombing of Cambodia led directly to the, you know, vicious, bloodthirsty Pol Pot regime, it does kind of appear like there might be a connection. And most of us seem to think, you know, all we've heard is the official propaganda is dished out by the mainstream media, because frankly, they're kind of lazy and don't do any investigative reporting these days. You've done a lot of research and found the roots of the struggle go way back, well before 9/11/2001. Did they go back, really, the struggle that a lot of the Arabs have with the great Western powers goes back to the end of World War One. You even found a quote from a British official on how to make war without boots on the ground. Tell us about those roots, please, you know, going back to 1919.
Yeah, well, I had sent you the first paragraph of a new article I'm working on, and this is really about the history of bombing and you know, again, tragically, the history of bombing in Iraq goes back as far as the history of bombing itself. It goes back to the First World War. And after the First World War, the British then, you know, at the instigation of the leaders of the newly formed Royal Air Force, the RAF, after World War One, they were essentially looking for, you know, how to make the RAF useful, you know, without a war, without a so-called war.
Right.
And so they basically developed the RAF bombing, mainly using firebombs to burn villages to the ground, as we're all familiar with in Vietnam. They developed this as a form of colonial policing. And the rationale for that was precisely the same as Obama's rationale today. It was the rationale of no boots on the ground. By bombing, you know, we avoid putting our soldiers in harm's way. And so, yes, I have a quote from a British official in Iraq from April 1919, 95 years ago, and he said, "All these tribal disturbances have been dealt with from the air. Thus, the army has been saved from marching many weary miles over bad country and sustaining casualties." So,
it didn't work real well, though, did it?
I'm sorry?
I haven't seen a lot of peace and justice ever since then. It didn't seem to work particularly well.
Right. And the fact that Western air forces are still bombing the same countries a century later is really a staggering failure of politics, humanity, and imagination. And this was, you know, and this was all evident as these campaigns began 100 years ago. Colonial officials in Iraq complained to London in reports saying that, you know, bombing innocent civilians was really a very ineffective way of dealing with political problems, and that it was much better to actually sit down and talk to these people and find out what their grievances were. But in fact, of course, once the bombing began, things went in a very different direction. And very soon, the RAF bombing in Iraq had essentially become a form of tax collection. As the British tried to impose taxes on, you know, these tribes all over Iraq, many of them had always managed to avoid paying taxes to the Ottoman Turks who ruled them before. And so when people didn't pay their taxes, rather than sending somebody to talk to them and see what could be worked out, the British simply sent bombers over their villages to firebomb them. And one of the leaders of a squadron in Iraq was a fellow by the name of Arthur Harris, who's better known to history as Air Chief Marshal Harris, Bomber Harris, or Butcher Harris, who was the head of RAF Bomber Command in World War II and was responsible for using the same strategies against places like Hamburg and Dresden. And as he firebombed villages in Iraq, he wrote in a report in 1924, "The Arab and the Kurd now know what real bombing means in casualties and damage. They now know that within 45 minutes, a full-sized village can be practically wiped out and a third of its inhabitants killed or injured." And so this was, you know, this was Britain's colonial policing in Iraq. And so when we look at U.S. and British and other Western air forces now bombing Iraq and Syria, instead of dealing with the grievances that led to this huge revolt of the mainly Sunni Arab people of northern and western Iraq, you know, we see that, you know, this has essentially been going on for 100 years. You know, we need political and diplomatic solutions to these problems. As I wrote in that article on September the 11th, the leaders of the Sunni uprising in Anbar province, that's Fallujah and Ramadi, where this began over the last couple of years, and of course it goes back to, you know, the massacre of people in Fallujah by U.S. Marines in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
What the leaders of this, what the local tribal leaders leading this rebellion have told the media in interviews is that ISIS really comprises a small number of the resistance fighters who are taking part in this rebellion. And that if their grievances are addressed, they can get rid of ISIS. You know, obviously we haven't tried to put this to the test, but, you know, really there are already three forces on the ground in Syria and Iraq who have proved themselves to be effective in dealing with ISIS. One is those Sunni Arab tribes in western and northern Iraq, where they have sought to contain or to eliminate ISIS, have been able to do so. They previously had kicked ISIS out of Fallujah. And the second one is the Syrian army, who have been effectively fighting against the Western-backed jihadis in Syria now for 3.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the third one is the people we're now suddenly hearing about in Kobane and the larger area of Rojava, which is Syrian Kurdistan.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these are the local defense forces of Syrian Kurdistan who are affiliated with the PKK.
Right.
Now, the PKK have been fighting the Turkish government in Turkey to defend and support the rights of Kurds, who comprise about 20% of the population of Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
They've been fighting for years for autonomy for Kurds in Turkey. Now, the PKK and the YPG, which is the PKK-affiliated forces in Syria, have also effectively kept ISIS out of their territory, and they are currently fighting them in this town, Kobane, on the Turkish border. And reports today are saying that they are now successfully pushing ISIS out of the parts of Kobane that that ISIS had moved into. So here we have three forces on the ground. The U.S. refuses to talk to the Sunni tribal leaders in Iraq. The U.S. regards the Syrian army as another enemy,
right,
and it regards the PKK. The PKK is officially classified as a terrorist group by the U.S. State Department. So while our leaders are claiming to be fighting, you know, some kind of all-out war against ISIS, you know, they are refusing to actually work with the three groups on the ground who actually have the ability to deal with ISIS. So this is, you know, this is really, you know, just an incredibly misguided policy on the part of our political leaders, and a lot of it seems to be politically motivated. They seem to be determined to appear to be doing something forceful to deal with this problem, when in fact they are not willing to adopt the policies that could actually be effective in dealing with it.
You know, it's amazing how, you know, it seems like the more one learns about realities here, the more questions are raised about why we are doing what we are. And before President Obama made his speech launching the latest version of a war, a lot of people, there was no lack of discussion on the political reality, as you, Nicholas, were just talking about, that the government of Syria, the government of Iran, they don't like ISIS either. And that we could, perhaps, you know, since ISIS was so bad, that we could actually start to work with them. There was that better policy out there and available to us. And you've probably read Barbara Tuchman's book, The March of Folly, when a good workable policy is known and yet government does something which is obviously not going to work. What do you think? If we're not working with these guys, as you just mentioned, who could actually defeat and disarm and destroy the threat of ISIS, why are we doing what we're doing? Is it just because, gosh, war is kind of fun and it's very profitable? I mean, really, what's your sense of this, Nicholas? What is the real purpose? Are we just trying to build a new war that's going to last for quite a few years and not actually resolve anything?
Well, there certainly are powerful interests that drive a lot of this. And throughout all of this history we're talking about, the U.S. has essentially placed all of its eggs in one basket in terms of dealing with international problems. You know, it's bombing, 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 and bombing, you know, every time. And yes, this is hugely profitable for the interests that drive that. And yet at the same time there is also a political dimension to this, in which, you know, we have a president, a democratic president who constantly seeks to sort of split the difference. Rather than take strong stands for peace and diplomacy, as obviously, you know, most of the people who voted for him in 2008 were hoping, and as obviously the Nobel Committee that awarded him the Peace Prize was hoping, instead he keeps splitting the difference between the hawks and really the more rational diplomatic and political solutions. And so, you know, and of course this then, you know, of course people like John McCain and Lindsey Graham will still attack him anyway.
Right.
but this has been the way he's approached things. He adopted a so-called dual-track approach to, you know, what it has really become clear was a non-existent nuclear weapons program,
right,
in Iran. You know, every piece of evidence that Iran has ever tried to develop nuclear weapons has been debunked.
Right.
Gareth Porter wrote a fantastic book about that came out earlier this year called Manufactured Crisis. And yet Obama adopted a policy of absolutely draconian sanctions, backed up by threats of military force, you know, that have been incredibly debilitating for the people of Iran, while of course doing nothing to affect its government. If anything, they've only stiffened,
sure,
as these kind of punitive policies do. They've only stiffened and united the people of Iran behind their civilian nuclear program, so that it's now a complete non-starter to, you know, to ask them to abandon that, and so, but this was of course a political compromise, Obama's policy, and And in many other areas, we've seen the same thing. He's pursued these proxy wars and covert wars to keep, you know, U.S. power projection out of the headlines and off the TV screen, while expanding the use of U.S. special forces around the world. It's been, the Pentagon has admitted that since Obama took office, U.S. special forces have conducted operations in at least 134 different countries. And this is more than double the number that was ever reported during the Bush administration.
Wow.
So, you know, this has been, you know, really, frankly, a cynical, political, split-the-difference approach to all of these problems by the Obama administration. Instead of really standing up for political and diplomatic solutions, which do exist,
yes,
to all
do.
These problems.
Yes.
Now, and part of this, I wrote an article for Z Magazine back in 2012, before the presidential election that year, detailing the connections between President Obama himself and the Crown family in Chicago, who have really bankrolled a lot of his political career. Now, they are the family of Henry Crown and his son Lester Crown, who both served as CEOs of General Dynamics. In fact, Henry Crown bought General Dynamics in 1959 and built it during the 60s and 70s into the largest weapons manufacturer in the world. So Obama's image as, you know, a liberal progressive president,
not true,
really needs to be tempered by his own personal connections with the military-industrial complex, who he has served very well. In that article, I really went through in some detail. I went through how General Dynamics has benefited from the war on terror and from some of Obama's policies, such as his expansion of the Virginia class submarines from, you know, which we were only building one a year, and he has expanded that to where we are now building two of those nuclear-powered attack submarines every year, and how under Obama the Zumwalt-class destroyer was saved, even though a Navy spokesman called it a weapon system you don't need, because the Chinese and others have now developed shore-to-ship missile, you know, surface-to-surface missiles that make these new ships highly vulnerable to attack. And yet, you know, we are still building a pilot program, I think, of three of these ships. And with all the development costs that have already gone into them, plus the cost of these three ships, this amounts to sinking, I think it's at least $12 billion into something that, as I say, the Navy says it does not need and does not want. So, and this is, you know, this is, again, another program of General Dynamics, President Obama's long-term political sponsor.
Interesting. We're talking on the Bert Cohen Show today with guest Nicholas Davies, the author of Blood on Our Hands, the American Invasion and Destruction of Iraq. He's got a new article, Since 9/11, America's Insane Foreign Policy Continued Under Obama Has Killed a Million and Created ISIS. So we're talking about a policy that makes a lot of money for interests like General Dynamics, but ISIS, you know, it does seem to me like, geez, you watch the news, the more we bomb ISIS or areas around them or allegedly bomb ISIS, the more they grow, oddly enough, the more real estate they claim. ISIS, you know, they're bad guys. We oppose sending troops back in. But, you know, another factor, it seems to me, that doesn't often get talked about is American long-term relations with the monarchy of Saudi Arabia. I wonder if you could talk about their involvement, the effect of the monarchy in Saudi Arabia and its effects on politics in the Middle East.
Yeah, I mean, it is incredible that this long-term alliance between the United States and Saudi Arabia, you know, even as our propaganda vilifies and demonizes a succession of other governments and regimes and leaders around the world, and now, of course, our bête noire, our new demon is ISIS,
right?
And the the flagship thing that they do, that we love to hate, is that they behead people.
Right.
Well, guess what? You know, Saudi Arabia beheaded 19 people in about a 10-day period in the month of August.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is criminal justice in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Many of those beheaded were convicted of drug crimes. You know, we're now in this country starting to question the war on drugs and to back off on draconian punishments for drug possession and even drug dealing. In Saudi Arabia, you get your head cut off for any of that stuff.
How does that affect the growth of ISIS? You know, that, I mean, what is Saudi Arabia's role in this whole larger political picture?
Right. Well, Saudi Arabia and Qatar, mm-hmm, and Kuwait and United Arab Emirates,
the rich
have
countries,
all helped to funnel fighters and weapons into Syria to try and overthrow the secular government of Bashar Assad. Now, and in fact, the quite popular government of Bashar Assad, even as NATO planes were flying weapons and fighters from Libya to Syria at the end of 2011, the Qataris sponsored a YouGov opinion poll by a British polling firm in Syria, and they found that 55% of Syrians still supported their government. They still supported Bashar Assad. And as an opposition leader in Syria has said, you know, the jihadis have turned Assad into the defender of minorities in Syria. This, you know, when, like the Sunni Arab tribes in Iraq, when a lot of people in Syria are faced with a choice between Bashar Assad and ISIS, they prefer Bashar al-Assad for very logical reasons, and for the same reasons that the Sunni Arabs in Iraq prefer ISIS to Shiite death squads who come after them. I think I've strayed a bit from your question there.
Meandering is fine.
Asking about the role of Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
Saudi Arabia, according to, you know, well-documented evidence, you know, from the New York Times and other sources, funded shipping plane loads of weapons left over from the wars in the Balkans from Croatia to Turkey. You know, Turkey has also played an incredibly insidious role in the civil war in Syria. Essentially, it provides safe haven to ISIS and other groups. Wounded fighters from ISIS and other jihadi groups are able to go into Turkey and, you know, be treated in hospitals in Turkey, and then go back to fight again. Turkey has completely flung open its borders and its airports for an inflow of weapons. Qatar is documented to have sent 70 plane loads of weapons to to Turkey and I think maybe to Jordan. But, you know, these, you know, the U.S., I mean, again, just as this history going back to colonialism and the British use of bombing in Iraq, you know, we really should reflect on the fact that our allies today in the Arab world are not the democratic forces in the Arab world. They are the royalist forces in the Arab world, the absolute monarchs of Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf states and Jordan. You know, these are all monarchies. You know, the United States had a revolution to throw out King George in 1776, and yet today, in our you know, major foreign policy crisis of the moment, we are allied with the last few remaining feudal monarchs in the world.
And it seems so interesting that so many wars, including the First World War, really had this very large element. They were painted one way, but the reality was there was a very large element of class war, quite frankly. And, you know, there was royalty defending its power versus everybody else. And they had this war to, you know, avoid the people fighting against those in power. And, you know, it just seems to go on and on and on. And the Saudis, from what I hear, are deathly, the royal family is deathly afraid of the people actually rising up there. And they've been pretty good at handing out, you know, little bits of money from time to time and just buying off the population. But they are very, very wealthy and they want to retain their power. And I wonder about places like Libya. You know, the U.S. Helped overthrow the government of Libya, and now it's massive chaos. Is this related to the whole scene that we've been talking about, Nicholas?
Well, yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, that I think Syria is a good example, because when the Arab Spring took place, right, and people in countries all over the Arab world took to the street. They overthrew a dictator in Tunisia. They overthrew a dictator in Egypt, although, you know, the army has never really relinquished control and is now back fully in charge. In Syria, you had peaceful demonstrations that were clearly brutally repressed by, you know, by a quite a nasty government. But the people, the various groups in Syria who organized those protests and who came together, they came together in the summer of 2011 and formed what they called the National Coordinating Body for Democratic Change. They still exist. And they're made up of mostly leftist and democratic parties in Syria. And in fact, the Russians have tried many times to get them involved in diplomacy to resolve the crisis. Because, these are the kind of people who really could help a legitimate political transition in Syria, which is clearly what's needed. And yet those people have been completely marginalized by the U.S. and its allies. They have been the dialogue that they sought to have in about the future of Syria has been completely overwhelmed by the dialogue of violence inflicted on the country by the U.S. and its allies. And yet they are still there, and they have from day one had three basic principles. One is non-sectarianism, you know, no conflict between different sects, non-violence, and no foreign intervention. These are the democratic forces that if, you know, if the United States in its foreign policy really stood for what it claims, what our leaders keep claim to stand for, then, you know, these are the kind of forces that would deserve our support and do deserve our support. That somehow, because the U.S. interest, the U.S. corporate interest, the interest of wealthy Americans with their investments around the world and their big business around the world, you know, are more interested in alliances and relationships with people like the royal family of Saudi Arabia.
Right.
There are solutions to all of these problems, but they require, you know, a very different approach by our government.
Which we are so far not taking. We're just doing the same old, same old. And it doesn't seem that, you know, we have a sense of public relations that's going to work. You write, Nicholas Davies, you write that, quote, millions of Iraqis see an alliance with ISIS as a lesser evil than submission to the brutal U.S. What part of ISIS may actually be less dangerous, bloodthirsty religious fanatics than people legitimately resisting the illegal invasion and brutal occupation of their country? Any guesses to, you know, those people who are drawn to ISIS because they're, you know, at least fighting what are clearly was a brutal American occupation and oppression by the government that we installed there. You know, what percentage do you think is that, rather than the picture that we're getting of just crazy, bloodthirsty religious fanatics?
Right. Well, I mean, it's a matter of self-preservation and survival. You know, when people find themselves in war zones, find their countries invaded and destroyed, you know, obviously self-preservation and survival become number one.
Sure.
And as Iraqis resisted our invasion and occupation of their country, part of the U.S. response to that, which I wrote about in my book, but which, you know, there's been little mainstream coverage of, we sent people to recruit and train Shiite militias for the Iraqi Interior Ministry, who became death squads and then targeted Sunni Arab areas, rounding up young men and boys, taking them away, torturing them, and then killing them and dumping them in rivers or dumping them in mass graves or delivering them to the morgue. And, you know, this was covered in the mainstream Western media as sectarian violence. But this was the result of deliberate U.S. policies. As this began in 2004, as we started training and recruiting these people, I quote a U.S. officer in my book who said, the Sunni population is paying no price for its support for the insurgents. We have to change that equation. You know, this was not an effort to identify resistance fighters and capture them. This was really a dirty war against the Sunni Arab population of Iraq, you know, based on terrorizing them by torturing and killing their sons and husbands.
I wonder, is this, you write about the federal police in Iraq, is that what you're talking about here?
Yes, exactly. When they were recruited back in 2004, they were called the Special Police Commandos, the Interior Ministry Special Police Commandos. In November 2005, one of their torture centers was discovered by a regular U.S. Army unit and, you know, exposed to the media. And so they were then rebranded at that point as the National Police, and then as sort of that, you know, it became clear that nothing had really changed. That was eventually rebranded again as the Federal Police. They now, in the current crisis, have even sort of outsourced this more to militias less loosely, more loosely connected with the interior ministry. But there has been, under this present crisis, there has been another huge upsurge of death squad activity by Shiite militias and interior ministry forces in Iraq. And so for Sunni Arabs in Anbar province and in Diyala and Nineveh provinces, Mosul and Tikrit and all those areas, they feel safer under ISIS, however repressive they may be, than being left at the mercy of the Iraqi government's death squads. So, that's the basic political situation that needs to be changed in Iraq. That is the key to solving the problem, is to actually grant the protection of the lives of Sunni Arabs in Iraq, to grant them basic civil and political rights that they were promised when we invaded their country and that they have been denied ever since. This is the reason for their rebellion, and this is why they see ISIS as a lesser evil than their own government.
It's amazing. I mean, in one sense, it's unbelievable. It's sickening, but ISIS seems to be the most organized resistance. And in your article, you write that leaders like, I hope I pronounce this right, Al-Hatam al-Suleiman claims that ISIS fighters make up only 5% of resistance fighters in Iraq. And, as you say, there are obvious solutions. It doesn't seem like we're taking those. Do you have any degree of optimism for the future?
Well, I guess I have some optimism because, there is an organized peace movement in this country. There are many, well-organized groups that now, after 13 years of war, have really become quite well-organized. And, groups like Peace Action, United for Peace and Justice, Win Without War, I've done quite a lot of work with Progressive Democrats of America.
Mm-hmm.
And a year ago, when our government threatened to attack Syria, it's since being revealed, was actually, at the time, they only talked openly of maybe 100 cruise missile strikes. In fact, what they were planning was just a devastating attack on the Syrian military, every part of the Syrian military. And yet, it never happened because people really rose up in protest against that. Hundreds of thousands, maybe even a million Americans picked up the phone, called their members of Congress or emailed them to say, no, this is not what we want.
And we can do it. The power is still there. And it's easy to paint the picture of ISIS. And, nobody's for ISIS. But, the bombing doesn't seem to be working. It seems to be making ISIS grow exponentially and their territory be solidified. It's clearly not working. This has been very, very interesting. If people are interested in reading more of your insights and your research, what would you suggest they look at on the web, Nicholas Davies?
Well, I urge people to read my book, Blood on Our Hands, The American Invasion and Destruction of Iraq, to understand the background to this. Most of my recent articles have been published by Alternet.
Oh, yes.
But if you just Google... And if you Google me, you'll see my page at Alternet with links to all my articles. So that's just Nicholas J.S. Davies. That's Nicholas without an H, Davies with an E. Nicholas J.S. Davies. You can read my articles about Syria, Iraq, Ukraine, and the overall crisis in U.S. foreign policy.
Well, I hope to be talking again. Very, very insightful. Thank you so much for being with us, Nicholas Davies. And it does seem like we've seen this before. Kind of a deja vu, isn't it?
All over again.
Thank you.
Another time around the wheel, I would probably know just how to